Candace Leijer, what sentence does Officer Crenshaw face now that he's been convicted in 8 of the cases?
Officer Holtzclaw?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Yes. What's the sentence?
So he was convicted of 18 of the 36 counts. The total sentence added up to 263 years. So the recommendation by the jury was that that sentence would be served consecutively. I think now at this point, we want to make sure that that sentence is actually served consecutively when the sentencing date occurs, and that takes place January 21st. At that time, the judge can decide if it's going to be consecutive or concurrent. Concurrent would mean he would serve all of his time at once. Mm. So since the maximum sentence was 30 years, he would serve approximately 85% of that, which would be about 28 and a half years.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Candace Leijer and Grace Franklin, co-founders of OKC Artists for Justice and Oklahoma City, and Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, law professor at UCLA and Columbia. We're going to continue this discussion, and we'll post it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now through December 15th, Fire on the Mountain on 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, Mike's Drive-In in Selwood, the Cup and Saucer on Northeast Killingsworth, and the Old Salt Supper House on Northeast 42nd Avenue will collect clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves, and the folks at Zippity News will distribute them to local shelters. Dropbox locations and more information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the December 19th show features Crow Quill Night Owls, Caleb Plotter and Reed Wilms, and Miller and Saucer, and hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, December 19th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Yeah. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a proposed liquefied natural gas pipeline on the Oregon coast gets federal approval.
28,000 gallons of raw sewage leaked into a creek in southwest Portland.
And we'll hear analysis on how the Paris Climate Agreement left out the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, the U.S. military. Good evening. This is the KBOO News for December 15th, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. The Jordan Cove Liquefied Natural Gas Terminal Project in Coos Bay has received approval for its environmental impact from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. As long as all other remaining approvals go through as expected before early 2016, construction will start late next year. State Treasurer Ted Wheeler, who is also running as mayor of Portland, is a member of the State Land Board. This board is different from the Department of State Lands, which is supposed to be making the decision. Wheeler said he'd be willing to take on the approval process, but he's not going to take any action, saying he wants to let the process take its course. Opponents of the project object in part to the impact the terminal would have on local sea life and the fishing economy. Lily Clausen from the Clausen Oysters Farm in Coos Bay said that sustainability of the oyster businesses in Coos Bay would be threatened by the pipeline and port. She says that construction of a pipeline would release silt and potentially destroy most of the oyster production. Wheeler said there would be a public meeting in Coos Bay to gather input on the permit applications. The state has also extended, by another month, the public comment deadline, which is now January 8th.
Around 28,000 gallons of raw sewage leaked into a tributary of Fennel Creek in southwest Portland last night. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Services has warned residents to keep out of the water at least through Wednesday. The leak began in a manhole on southwest Shattuck Road, and city officials say it was caused by the excessive rain combined with a blockage of rocks, roots, grease, and all three. Local resident Stan Hausman has been working for years to get the city to change its approach to sewage treatment in the area of Fennel Creek. He says that the city made its first mistake in the year 2000 when it constricted a combined sewer water and storm water pump station that required water to flow uphill, and that the Bureau of Environmental Services has continued to make more mistakes since then.
The thing is built with flaws in it from the very outset, i.e. it makes right turns as it goes up the hill, which every time you put a kink in it, it causes more the pump to have to push that much harder as it is that it's going uphill anyway. But then with the added kinks and twists and turns to the thing, it just, you know, they have to continually push harder and harder and harder, i.e. the reason for the second pump station is now the first one is acting as a backup. And that one never worked very well in the beginning. And now this one, they're expecting it to work better than the first, but it still has the same basic problems of, A, it's pushing a mountain of sewage up a mountain, and then with all the twists and turns to it, it just adds to the complexity of it. So it doesn't seem like it's well-designed from the outset.
Is it your opinion that the Bureau of Environmental Services should rethink the Fano pump station altogether and maybe consider a different type of pump, or what do you think is the best solution in this situation?
Well, we believe that gravity is the kinder and more gentler solution to this. It could go down to Clean Water Services, down to Durham, if, you know, they were willing to, pay for the added expense in that direction. And the thing that's, I think, amazes me the most is now with building two complete pump stations here, I don't see how this was a savings in the long term. Which was the whole reason why they decided to build it and push it uphill in the first place, is that they thought they would save money. But after and the ratepayers of Portland are paying for this and paying for this and paying for this. And it's like there's no end in sight.
on the Bureau of Environmental Services website for the city of Portland when they talk about the Fano pumping station. They say that the system is designed to prevent uncontrolled sewage overflows during very heavy rainstorms by pumping wastewater out of the sewer, forcing it through a filtration system to remove debris, and discharging the wastewater into Fano Creek until the heavy rains subside. Now, this is supposed to be a temporary measure while this new pumping station gets into place. But in your opinion, it should be a different solution altogether, a gravity-fed filtration and pumping system?
Yes, that would make the most sense. I have, through these heavy rains, we have had three subsequent floods in our backyard, which go down the side of our house. We don't use any pumps. We just have it trenched so that the water will go from the backyard down along the side and out. That's gravity working at its best versus trying to pump it back up to some unknown higher level for some reason so it can break down and fall and come right back into the yard and flood the house instead.
Has there been any response from the City of Portland, Bureau of Environmental Services, or any other city agency to your proposals or the proposals of other residents?
Every time we tried to come up with a different solution for them, it was always, no, they knew better. They knew how to do this. They've got this down now. And each time they would fix, you know, the broken pipe or the connector or whatever was the issue, and then each time it would just break in a different place in the same way. So they, you know, their sense of a community or a citizen participation effort is nil, as they are the experts and the people that live in the environment have no real say in this product or project.
Wow. And again, we're speaking with Stan Hausman. He is a local resident and activist on this issue, has been involved for a number of years in trying to challenge the Bureau of Environmental Services method of dealing with wastewater in the area around Fano Creek and the new Southwest 86th Avenue pump station is again delayed. It was supposed to be opened by now. Even when it goes online, according to Hausman and other residents of the area, will not solve the problem of sewage leaks into Fano Creek. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Portland Public School Board will hold its regular monthly meeting this evening at 6 p.m. Testifying this evening will be several members of a local nonprofit whose aim is to stop the expansion of cell phone towers on school property. The board is scheduled to renew a contract with cell tower providers to allow them to maintain a number of towers at Portland Public Schools. Members of the local nonprofit, known as Wireless Education Action, will testify against the scheduled renewal of cell tower leases. Three of the schools in question are elementary schools. In the past, the school district has maintained a policy of not leasing school property as a location for cell towers. It appears that the school board is poised to go against this policy and renew leases despite evidence that microwave radiation from cell towers may cause cancer, neurological, genotoxic, psychological, and other devastating health problems.
In this day and age, for a school board to voluntarily lease their property to for cell phone siting, completely insane. I doubt that they have been through the contemporary science, because the science that dates back over 60 years shows that this can cause grave harm, especially to children who are much more susceptible to the effects of radio frequency radiation. A world-renowned scientist, Dr. Martin Paul, who lives here in Portland, is going to be addressing them, and he just published a paper a couple years ago that was voted the best medical paper of 2013, and it closes the gap between not knowing that the exact thing that causes cancer. And it breaches that what they call incomplete evidence. So so now there is evidence, and any doubt really now is coming from the telecom industry. They're the ones who are using the tobacco industry playbook of creating doubt and, arguing against there being any science, calling it pseudoscience and all this stuff.
I have heard criticism that Dr. Martin Paul might be engaging in pseudoscience. How do you respond to this?
Depends on who's creating those statements. There's a tremendous amount of competition within the science community. I think probably the one problem that people have is that there are most likely other mechanisms that will be found. So people are saying that this is not the only mechanism. So that is, I think, what part of the problem is. People are interpreting what he's saying that this is the only mechanism, but he doesn't say that at all, actually. Because, I've seen things here and there, but it depends on where, about all the bloggers that are corporate shills who will check into blogs and they'll start name-calling and discounting science and scientists, and they just like to create controversy.
If there's overwhelming evidence that cell towers really do have the potential to cause cancer, why would schools allow it on their property?
For money. They're told, the telecom industry will send 3 or 4 guys in, and they'll talk to them, and they'll tell them that everything's okay, and they'll show them quotes from the FCC, which says that it's safe, and they don't go any further than that. They don't go into any of the actual science or studies.
So have there been cases in other school districts in Oregon or even throughout the country?
Probably throughout the country, yeah. There's a woman in Massachusetts who just got their school to do something about the Wi-Fi because her daughter was made sick by this.
So have you approached the Portland Public Schools about this issue in the past?
I tried to get together with them for about a year, and they refused to meet with me. So I told them that if they didn't meet with me, I was going to file a lawsuit. And they still wouldn't meet with me, and then we filed the lawsuit in 2011. And that was for the issue of Wi-Fi for chronic microwave exposure in schools. Even the Environmental Protection Agency acknowledged that this is a problem. Back, I think in 2002, there was one of their employees, Norbert Henken, who was from the Center for Science and Risk Assessment Radiation Protection Division, and he wrote a letter that said the FCC's current exposure guidelines, as well as those of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers and the International Commission of Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, are thermally based and do not... Thermally based means they're based on the heating of tissue and not based on exposure that will not heat tissue. And it says, do not apply to chronic non-thermal exposure situations. So even the EPA admitted that our standards are not at all protective of humans.
What are you expecting from the meeting with the school board?
I don't know what to expect. The school board, the last school board, was absolutely terrible. I think these people are maybe a little better, probably a lot better than the last group, and maybe a little more willing to look at some of this information. So I don't know.
So if nothing comes from the school board meeting, what's your next step?
Well, we might just start picketing the school board building or, doing something a little more aggressive. I can say with absolute certainty that if they put cell towers in these schools, which there already are, I believe there's already like 5 or 6 cell towers around, that children will die from that. Some children will definitely die from that at some point.
I've been speaking with David Morrison with Wireless Education Action, a local Portland nonprofit. We've been talking about the scheduled renewal of cell tower leases on Portland Public School property. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
The Portland Board of Education meeting will be held this evening at 6 p.m. at 501 North Dixon Street in Portland. The renewal of cell tower leases on school property is one of the items on the agenda for consideration.
Portland police have announced today that they are suspending their investigation into reported assault of Lewis and Clark student Tange Muvuna. Muvuna made a public statement on campus that he forgives his alleged attackers and does not wish to pursue charges. Muvuna is a scholarship student from Rwanda studying English at the college. He described the attack to Oregonian, where a number of people ganged up on him, punched, kicked, and forced him to drink an unknown liquid. The attack came just 2 days after Lewis and Clark students held a walkout in protest after racial slurs were used on a popular campus social media site. Since the attack, Muvuna has repeated his call for forgiveness toward his fellow students. The action, among others, prompted an occupation of the college president's manor by student activists of the Black Lives Matter movement. A new release from the police bureau's bias crimes unit states there is no further investigation to conduct without new information. Anyone with new information about these incidents is asked to contact Detective Todd Prosser at 503-823-9320.
Funding for new bike lanes in Portland may be on the chopping block as regional transportation officials consider the budget for the coming year. In a recent meeting of Metro's Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, a large group of decision-makers sent a signal that bikes are no longer a high priority. Several years ago, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance successfully campaigned for dedicated funding for sidewalks and bike lanes. This victory resulted in around $18 million worth of regional projects like Portland's Bike Share program in 2012. In 2016, the fund is supposed to provide $27 million worth of projects, including Portland's downtown multimodal safety project. But now, transportation officials are threatening to cut that funding. Several leaders from across the region have signaled their early desire to eliminate this dedicated funding and open up the precious regional flexible funds to be spent on road projects of any type, including freight projects. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance and other groups have called on supporters of safe streets and protected bike lanes to call transportation officials and demand that the funding be maintained.
The Portland Police Association has come under fire for its billboards that have been posted around Portland for the past 2 months. The billboards feature the phrase, "Having enough police matters." The phrasing is similar to the Black Lives Matter hashtag, whose purpose is to highlight excessive use of force by police. The similar wording and location of the signs has led to concern among members of the community. One billboard is located across the street from a Black Lives Matter sign on the First Unitarian Church on Southwest Salmon and 12th Avenue. Lisa Schroeder, owner of Mother's Bistro and Bar in downtown Portland, posted an article today on the Blue Oregon blog saying these signs delegitimize the message of the Black Lives Matter movement. Daryl Turner of the Portland Police Association has issued a statement in response to the location of the billboard. Turner said the location is coincidental and chosen by the advertising agency based on availability of spaces.
After the most recent mass shooting in San Bernardino, thousands of doctors nationwide are calling for more research into the underlying causes of gun violence. The Federal Centers for Disease Control has not funded research into gun violence since 1996, when lobbyists for the National Rifle Association convinced Congress to adopt a budget provision preventing the CDC from doing research that could promote gun control. At the same time, Congress stripped funding for firearms injury prevention research from the CDC. The organization, Doctors for America, announced earlier this month that more than 2,000 physicians had signed a petition urging Congress these barriers to research, that they research these barriers. Doctors for America is joining several other organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Preventive Medicine, and the National Physicians Alliance, in calling for the U.S. to once again fund research into gun violence and public health. According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, there have been 317 mass shootings in the U.S. so far this year, and altogether, more than 12,000 people in the U.S. have died due to gun violence.
You You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Nick Buxton on climate change and the military-industrial complex in the wake of the recent Paris Accord. This will be followed by Cutie Pock Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rain showers early in the day, overcast as the day unwinds. High of 46, low of 40. Today in history, in 1791, the Bill of Rights became law, with Virginia being the last state to ratify the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and revolutionary reforms which began with the Declaration of Independence. Also on this day in 1988, the hardest working man in show business became inmate number 155413. Legendary soul singer James Brown began his prison sentence in the state correctional institution in South Carolina. And the quote of the day is from the father of soul himself. When I'm on stage, I'm trying to do one thing, bring people joy, just like church does. People don't go to church to find trouble, they go there to lose it.
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Unlike the CEOs of most giant corporations, Don Blankenship's outward appearance actually reveals what's inside. An arrogant, conniving, cutthroat industrial thug. Not for nothing was this thick-set, mean-eyed West Virginian known as the Dark Lord of Coal Country. The longtime boss of mining behemoth Massey Energy generated profits by working miners to exhaustion, viciously busting unions, browbeating subordinates, running disgracefully unsafe mines, callously decapitating mountains as a cheap way to get at coal, willfully poisoning the region's waterways and people with toxic mining waste, and outright purchasing politicians to run errands for him. He measured the value of everything and everyone in dollars. By that measure, Blankenship has always put the dearest value on himself, taking $18 million in personal pay in 2010 alone, the same year his disregard for safety ripped apart 29 miners down in Massey's Upper Big Branch mine. He gets chauffeured around in a Bentley and a helicopter. He vacations on the French Riviera, and his primary mansion is a vast gated estate. But he also enjoys his nearby entertainment home, a four-story castle pretentiously perched on a mountain peak, so all the serfs can see that he is lord of the realm. But Lord Don has taken a great fall, ousted as CEO in 2010 and recently convicted of a conspiracy that led to the needless deaths of those 29 miners. He's also widely despised because, as one local put it, he betrayed his own people. Of course, he's so narcissistic and materialistic that he says, "I don't care what people think." At the end of the day, Don Blankenship is going to die with more money than he needs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if anyone ever deserved to die with nothing but a sack of cold cash to comfort him, this greedy industrialist is that person.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today is my second commentary about what I call the cancer industrial complex. Last week I focused on the ongoing scandal of large cancer-causing corporations being major donors and partners to some of the largest and most well-endowed nonprofit organizations in the world, those that claim to be battling the cancer epidemic, such as the American Cancer Society and the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and the Komen Foundation. Today I'm going to focus my outrage on what the American Cancer Society does and does not do with the almost $1 billion it raises annually. The American Cancer Society is the world's wealthiest nonprofit organization, but it might as well be a fake nonprofit organization, as it's, quote, more interested in accumulating wealth than saving lives, unquote, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy. If you put the words prevent cancer into Google, what comes up are endless pages of reminders that many cancer deaths could be prevented by making healthy choices like not smoking, staying at a healthy weight, eating right, keeping active, etc. This is all true and important for people to understand. But cancer deaths from poor lifestyle choices are massively overshadowed by another category of cancer deaths that virtually nobody talks about, and that a Google search won't help you find much information about. I'm talking about the ongoing poisoning of our air, our water, our food, and our soil, from pharmaceutical corporations, fossil fuel and nuclear energy corporations, automobile corporations, cosmetics corporations, agricultural and food processing corporations, and logging corporations. These industries produce pesticides, herbicides, cosmetics, radiation, fossil fuels, tire dust, and food additives, many of which cause cancer. And many of these same corporations donate massive sums of money to the American Cancer Society year after year. Winning the war on cancer means preventing cancer, but cancer-causing corporations and cancer-treating corporations are multi-billion dollar businesses. Preventing cancer may be good for we the people, but it's bad for business. So don't expect the American Cancer Society to focus on preventing cancer anytime soon. And let's not forget, most of the poisoning that large corporations do is perfectly legal. It's background normal. Regulatory agencies grant permits, which permit so-called safe levels of poison in parts per million, neatly calculated by so-called experts. It's business as usual. So the American Cancer Society, in its deal with the devil, focuses very little of its massive endowment on preventing cancer, and almost all of its financial resources and research on detecting cancer, and treating cancer, and surviving cancer, and curing cancer, which, if you think about it, is a giant scam, because detecting and treating and surviving and curing cancer is in itself a multi-billion dollar industry of another whole set of pharmaceutical and mammography and hospital corporations profiting handsomely on people's pain and suffering. If we really want to tackle the cancer epidemic in this country, we need to start by doing two things. One, ban all corporations from donating to the nonprofit sector, as was once the law in the U.S. until the late 1800s. And two, begin to pass community rights laws that strip corporations of their constitutional so-called right to poison us. If we did these two things, we would see an immediate and massive drop in new cancers across the country. Here's my proposed first tiny little step forward to begin this urgent effort to wake people up. Listen carefully. Imagine what might happen this year in downtown Portland if dozens or perhaps even hundreds of us converged at the entrance of the annual Relay for Life on Friday, May 13, to help expose the fraud that is the American Cancer Society, which preys on the suffering of those who have cancer or know someone who has cancer, which is almost everyone these days. The Relay for Life is the world's largest cancer fundraising event. I want you, yes, you, the person listening to my voice right now, to contact me today and tell me that you would like to be one of the dozens or perhaps hundreds of participants this year on Friday, May 13, to educate the participants of this year's Relay for Life, who will once again be wasting their hard-earned money on a fraud. Let's gently reach out to these thousands of good people with the information they will need to redirect their hard-earned money to a different kind of anti-cancer effort, one that focuses its work primarily on preventing cancer in the first place by dismantling the corporate state that makes the cancer epidemic inevitable. Will you join me on Friday, May 13, at the entrance to the Relay for Life in downtown Portland? I really mean this. Who will join me? Or perhaps you live elsewhere and would like to set up a similar action at another one of the more than 5,000 Relay for Life events across the U.S. Please contact me, Paul Cienfuegos, via my website at paulcienfuegos.com. Let me know that you're with me. Share this commentary with your friends and neighbors and get them to contact me too. Let's do this. Thank you. Next week, I'll be talking about Dr. Samuel Epstein and other heroes who have been bravely challenging the cancer industrial complex for decades. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cnfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
This morning, an electronic threat was made to an unspecified number of Los Angeles schools. As a result, more than 900 schools were closed, affecting over 640,000 students. The whole area has been on edge since a mass shooting last week in nearby San Bernardino, in which 14 people were killed. In this clip, Los Angeles School Police Chief Steven Zipperman talks about the police reaction to this morning's threat.
This morning, at just after 5 o'clock, I received a phone message from Chief Zipperman, the school police, and he shared with me the threat that had been made to not one school, but many schools in this school district. He shared with me that some of the details talked about backpacks, talked about other packages. I want every school searched to make sure that it is safe for children and safe for staff to be there on Wednesday.
Earlier this morning, we did receive an electronic threat that mentioned the safety of our schools. As a result of that threat, the Los Angeles School Police Department, as well as Los Angeles Police Department and the FBI were notified, and right now the threat is still being analyzed. In an abundance of caution, as Superintendent Cortinas has indicated, we have chosen to close our schools today until we can be absolutely sure that our campuses are safe. And until it is deemed safe by law enforcement and concurred with our district officials, which we believe will be able to occur by the end of this day, we will keep those schools closed.
That was LA School Superintendent Ramon Cortinas and School Police Chief Steven Zipperman on the closing of over 900 schools today in Los Angeles.
Arun Kundnani, who last year wrote the book The Muslims Are Coming, released a statement today commenting on the rising tide of Islamophobia sweeping the nation. Almost 50 states, state governors, and representatives have already rejected the influx of refugees with the refrain that, quote, security trumps compassion, end quote, and now Donald Trump is projecting it as a national stance. Kundnani says that we've been told many lies in general, but the lie about Islam and the plight of the refugees fleeing war-torn Syria and the rest of the Middle East is particularly troubling.
This one is particularly compelling because of the situation in the Middle East. And so, you know, the idea that, and because it's been well-funded, you know, there's been millions of dollars from various kinds of think tanks that have systematically wanted to put this agenda out there, that there is something inherent about Islam that turns people into terrorists. It's not as if this is the only lie that is being believed. People believe all kinds of things as well, but this one happens to be particularly prominent at a time when we've seen, the conflicts in the Middle East that involve Israel, that involve the United States, continue because of the ongoing foreign policy that we have. And as long as that foreign policy continues, as long as we continue to maintain an approach to the Middle East where we don't really want the people of the Middle East to be able to achieve self-determination of their own societies.
Kundnani said that for more than a decade now, we've been told the main thing that we need to be scared about is crazy Muslims coming to kill us. But the statistics tell a very different story. Actually, more deaths have resulted from actions of right-wing terrorists than Muslims. Browse to the Institute for Public Accuracy's website at accuracy.org for more information.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Israeli soldiers opened fire on Tuesday morning on several Palestinian farmers in their lands east of Deir al-Balah city in central Gaza. The soldiers, stationed near the Kusufim military base across the border fence southeast of Deir al-Balah, fired several live rounds on the farmers, forcing them to leave the area, fearing additional escalation. The army frequently targets farmers and workers in Palestinian lands close to the border fence, in addition to the numerous attacks targeting Gaza fishers and their boats in Gaza territorial waters, causing dozens of casualties, including fatalities, in addition to many arrests. On Monday at dawn, an Israeli Air Force carried out two airstrikes targeting training camp for Al-Qassam Brigades, the arming of Hamas, and the Palestinian Naval Police Center in Gaza. On Sunday, the army shot and injured a Palestinian farmer east of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday at dawn the southern West Bank city of Hebron and several nearby towns, searched and ransacked many homes, and kidnapped four Palestinians, including a former political prisoner. Also on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded the town of Silwad, east of the central West Bank city of Ramallah, and kidnapped four Palestinians, including the father of Anas Hamad, who was killed by the army fire on Friday, December 4th. On Monday late night, Israeli troops invaded Silwad and searched homes, in addition to confiscating electric equipment worth of 3,500 shekels from a car after stopping it on a military roadblock installed at the western entrance of the town. Moreover, Israeli soldiers also invaded on Tuesday at dawn Beit Jala city in the West Bank district of Bethlehem, searched homes and kidnapped a man from his home in Al-Jadail area. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Tuesday, December 15th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org.
Everyone knows the northern ice is melting as images of skinny polar bears float across dark water on islands of ice cleaves. The science is finally reaching public awareness in a way that is unavoidable and charged with consequence. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, released their report on the state of the Arctic. The report reveals the average air temperature this year was 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1.3 degrees Celsius, above the long-term average. This is the highest annual average recorded since monitoring began back in the year 1900. Along with the warming air comes melting ice. Half of Greenland's giant ice sheet experienced melting in 2015. The massive glaciers which make up the surface of Greenland's landmass are shrinking increasingly year by year. With shorter freezing seasons, old ice melts away as younger ice lives, even more vulnerable to melting. The impacts of these warmer cycles are consequently affecting the fragile ecosystems of the north. According to NOAA's Rick Spinrad, Arctic cod are moving north, algae are blooming in the Bering Sea, and walruses are hauling out record numbers. This creates increased struggles when it comes to mating and feeding their young. Biodiversity researcher Kit Kovacs stressed the uncertainty of the Pacific walruses in the Guardian report of the NOAA's 2015 Arctic Report Card.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla, Chris Andre, and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Jared Dantzler. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with host Paul Rowland. He'll be speaking with Nick Buxton, the co-editor of the recently released book The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations are Shaping a Climate-Changed World. We'll get a preview of this show on the next 15 minutes as KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaks with Buxton and the Paris Accord on the Paris Accord and the U.S. military. That's KBOO's News in Depth. Tomorrow morning at 9, it's Radio EcoShock. At 11, on The Food Show, host Chris Teagle speaks with Matt Newell Ching about changes coming to SNAP eligibility at the beginning of 2016. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support and for making KBOO a reality. If you are not a member today, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night.
Good night, Jared.
Good night, Nicole.
Stay tuned for the Tuesday News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're joined now by Nick Buxton. He's the co-editor of the new book, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations are Shaping a Climate-Changed World. And I want to talk about the military and their carbon emissions in relation to the recent Paris Climate Agreement. I understand that the military is the largest emitter of fossil fuels. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the U.S. Pentagon, one of the things